Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So President Trump did a little press avail before heading down to the border yesterday. And he was asked this question. Pain with respect to the shutdown.
Financial pain.
Human pain. Here's what the president had to say about what about the human pain, Mr. President? You know, those furloughed federal workers.
Well, you know who has more human pain? The parents of people who had children killed by an illegal immigrant that should have never been in the country. You know who has more human pain? The husband that lost the wife, or the wife that lost the husband to an illegal immigrant that came in five or six times that shouldn't be here. That's the human pain. And the people that will be paid, but maybe a little bit later, those people, many of them are on my side. They want to see border security. And by the way, NBC may be the most dishonest reporters of all time.
Well, a lot of competition for that title. Let's talk about human pain, because I know for many, the data is unpersuasive. And the common sense nature, the logic of the position to include a barrier as part of border security is irrelevant to them, because all they focus on is the sentimentality and the anecdotes offered by the left.
Well, there were a number, of rallies yesterday all across the country, even in Chicago, Atlanta, from people, TSA, DEA, some FBI agents, even Secret Service agents who are supposed to protect the president are not getting a paycheck today.
On behalf of more than 61,000 pilots of the Airline Pilots Association, we stand in solidarity with you.
But Bill Stifler, Bill Stifler's air traffic controller. His wife is pregnant.
We have the mortgage, car loan, cell phone, electric, gas, the utilities. We don't have to know what it's going to cost us now, once the baby's here.
And the baby, that NBC News put an ultrasound picture up of the baby. I'm not kidding you.
It really couldn't be any worse timing, because we want to be focusing on bringing the baby home and not worrying about when and if he's going to get paid.
It's a good example of why President Trump suggested NBC might be the most dishonest of them all in the D.C. press corps. And it's a prime example of what I'm talking about. Thank you for giving form to it.
But they did profile one man. I want to tell you, his name is NASA contractor Jim Sisko.
Because I stand behind my president, and I believe what he's doing is right. I believe we need the border wall.
So he doesn't mind not getting paid today. He stands behind him. So at least they tried to show the other side of the story.
Yeah.
For 6 seconds.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost 7 seconds.
There's this one outlier.
Yeah.
Let's talk about human pain. Because I know, despite what Mazie Hirono says about the problem Democrats have messaging, is they're too fact-oriented. They're too, the contentions they put forward are too data-rich. They need to be more emotional. All they have is empty emotion. So, you want to hear human pain? Reggie Singh, the brother of Newman, California police officer Ranil Singh, who was murdered by a person in this country illegally.
Yeah, known gangbanger, too.
Two-time convicted DUI. Hmm. Here's Reggie Singh. At the press conference December 28th, you remember this?
I wish I could thank all the law enforcement agencies Homeland Security in San Francisco, everyone, Bakersfield team. I was waiting for this to happen. I'd like to thank you, working day and night, to make this happen.
That was, of course, on the occasion of the arrest.
Yeah, and we did actually play that, so, I mean, because nobody else did. I have not heard that audio anywhere. Got lost in the holiday shuffle.
So you want to play this human game with the left and those in your circles of influence and contact. Let's do it. And you should do it.
Because eventually they're going to get paid, but he's never going to get his brother back, ever. And President Trump, I thought he did a great job yesterday of focusing, you know, not on the federal workers, but on the families who lost loved ones that were killed by illegal immigrants.
Reggie's.
And he brought Reggie down with him to the border when they
for that round table.
Yeah, for the round table. And then in front of them, and this kind of went by the wayside, all the arms and the weapons that were confiscated at the border, all the drugs, and not all of them, but the ones that just were tried to get, you know, through the border in the past month in McAllen, Texas.
Here's what Reggie Singh had to say when he sat down with Martha McCallum on Fox.
If he would have been deported, my brother would be alive right now. I would not be doing this interview. What I truly feel about this is, you know, if we make our immigration law stricter, if we take action and not allow an illegal immigrant to get second chance, I think that, you know, we could minimize the crime rate we are having.
And by the way, it shouldn't go unnoticed or shouldn't get lost that both Reggie and his brother Roneel, immigrants from Fiji, mm-hmm. who emigrated to this country legally. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan and Amy, it's unfortunate, but the sorrow that these police parents of police officers, brothers, and so forth, falls totally on deaf ears of liberals and the humanoids that I call them. Because they just don't care. They have nothing to do with it. They just hate Trump. So I'm suggesting change the argument. Instead of saying, you know, we're going to fight the border and all of that good stuff, you know, say San Francisco, how many do you want? Hinsdale, how many do you want? You elected Sean Kasten. Chicago, you're a sanctuary city. How many are you going to take in?
Mm-hmm.
Start putting these people where the liberals live and let them. That's the only way you're going to change their minds is that they're so far removed from any of this. That they just don't care. Policemen get killed. Who cares? It's just the policeman. But you know what? Put them in their neighborhood and let them deal with the problems with that. Then you might get some change. Have a nice day.
Thanks for the call, Ed. Yeah, I mean, and I think it goes back to the Bernie Shaw, Michael Dukakis moment between President Trump and the entire nation and his speech on Tuesday night. What if it was your brother, your wife? Your husband,
your son,
your daughter. Yeah. What if Roneel Singh was your relative? What would your position be?
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Is 2019 the year that there's finally a legal reckoning for R. Kelly? This Lifetime series, Surviving R. Kelly.
It's actually led to arrests.
Right. It's prompted even Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, who's opposed to arresting people.
And prosecuting
people, I should say. She's now wanting any women who've been assaulted, particularly minors, by R. Kelly to come forward.
Yeah, or any people that were entrapped in one of his compounds. Or any witnesses, which is a rare move. I have never seen her do that. And then it came out that she was a sexual abusive victim herself when she was a kid. So she's taking this matter to heart. But it all stems from
really?
That Lifetime show.
Oh, really? What's she doing on CPS?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Surviving R. Kelly.
And now I want to watch it.
Hmm.
But they've had so many protests in front of his recording studio, which is empty right now, and he owes $80,000 in rent, so he's not going to be there much longer. But he was partying at a bar 2 nights ago on the South Side. Did you see that?
Yeah.
While all of this was going on?
Well, so the women in this documentary, Surviving R. Kelly, as the name implies, all say Kelly abused them.
And we're actually going to have one of the abusers on Monday. one of who was allegedly abused. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that.
And by the way, you know, R. Kelly used to have this house in Olympia Fields that abuts Olympia Fields golf course.
Yeah.
And that now that the Isley brothers, one of the Isley brothers bought, because apparently that Isley brother was mad at his money. But anyway, I mean, it's just, you know, big spread. Walked away from it, completely trashed it.
Really? Trashed inside?
Yeah. Because the village ultimately had to go in and, I mean, you know, sort of be a conduit for the bank to take possession because R. Kelly just walked from it. This is a bad
dude.
I remember when he was being prosecuted for having sex with a minor.
Well, the tape, that one in 2002?
That's not me on that tape.
No, that wasn't me. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you're talking about.
Chappelle can get away with that. So he gets acquitted. He walks on that those charges. But during the trial, I'm at a boxing match.
Yeah.
R. Kelly walks in with his entourage, and the girl on his arm, I don't know how old she was, but...
She looked like a minor.
It was
just saying.
It was a close call at best.
Really?
Disgusting.
Well, I saw the tape because they asked us, we had it in the newsroom and said, who wants to watch it? I'll watch it. It was him on the tape. I thought it was him, but, you know, some jurors believed otherwise.
Yeah, well, everybody has their supporters, I suppose. This birthday party at V75 in Chicago you were mentioning.
Well, you go there, right?
Yeah. I don't.
You're a big clubber.
Never been there. My days of dancing on boxes and furry boots are over, Amy. Those days I put behind me. So this is a birthday party. Yeah. Cops show up. There was a dispatcher that put out a call that there was an arrest warrant for R. Kelly, but there was no arrest warrant.
So they really?
So they showed up, but he was allowed to go about his business. At his birthday, according to TMZ, he was surrounded by screaming fans, and he grabbed the mic and declared, I don't give a F about what's going on. Clear reference to the Surviving R. Kelly series. He had tons of fans on him, gassing him up, reports TMZ, as he sang the opening to Bump and Grind. Ah, yes, another wonderful moment for Chicago.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy were talking about that R. Kelly, R. Kelly birthday party at the Chicago nightclub. Tweet from Kevin Rooney, a birthday party. Let me guess how we put out the candles.
Oh.
No. I said only Chappelle can get away with the pee on me humor.
Trip, trip, trip. Sorry.
All right.
Oh, I want to play it so bad.
Okay. Control yourself.
Oh, fine.
Let's use it sparingly. Let's get back to the border. Matt Gaetz, Republican congressman from Florida, was on with Lou Dobbs. And he shared a personal anecdote of a conversation he had with Trump about this showdown over the shutdown, and offered a bit of an insight, I suppose, in terms of President Trump's posture.
What you just said reminded me of one of our last discussions where he said, Matt, I'm going to fight with everything I have for the forgotten Americans who want a secure border. And if I don't get it, I'm going to die with my boots on. That's the kind of resolve I want from the energetic executive that we have at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Someone who is willing to do everything he can to make sure that the American people see promises fulfilled.
Is that what you want from President Trump? Or do you want him to fold, or as Republicans normally say it, to find bipartisan compromise, to find middle ground, to do the bidding of the other side? Are you worried that as this partial shutdown continues on, and or he decides, as he repeated yesterday, that if the other side is going to be unreasonable, then he will exercise the emergency powers that he believes he has, and I think he's right, as the nation's executive, to direct the military, the Army Corps, whatever, to construct
the
wall.
Yeah, the Army Corps of Engineers. Mm-hmm. And people are squawking this morning that he's taking funds away from disaster relief, you know, from hurricane survivors in Puerto Rico and Texas.
So how should Trump respond to the squawking from all corners? The, but look, in a previous iteration of a steel paneled barrier, you were able to cut through it with a customary saw. And so it won't be effective. Oh, Nancy Pelosi now talking about El Chapo-style tunnels. Oh, well, they'll just build tunnels underneath the wall so it won't stop anything. Should Trump stand fast, or should he look for a covered retreat from his current position? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA. Turnkey.pro text line, because his position, as he explained to the assembled D.C. press corps before he headed to the border yesterday, pretty clear.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. The lawyers have so advised me. I'm not prepared to do that yet, but if I have to, I will. I have no doubt about it. I will. I have the absolute right to declare. This was passed by Congress. So when you say, was it passed by Congress? It was. Other presidents have used it, some fairly often. I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
What, there have been 58 national emergencies declared? Remember the Iran hostage crisis, 9/11, and pretty much they just redirect funds that have already received congressional approval, right? So then it would pay for his wall. But if the Democrats would work with him, we wouldn't even be in this position to begin with. And that's, you know, a point of contention with some saying, well, it's not a national emergency. It is a humanitarian crisis. I'm not going to deny that for 5 seconds. We do have a problem. And if we put up a wall, it will send a message to people not only in Mexico but in Central America, hey, don't come here.
National Review opining on the topic about the humanitarian crisis, even though they oppose Trump invoking the emergency powers he believes he has. But here's what the editorial board at National Review offered. It's an ongoing surge of minors and families from Central America that we are ill-equipped as a matter of law and resources to handle. That's the humanitarian crisis. Or as Pelosi and Pagliacci say, challenge. Okay. This category of migrant is the new normal, continues National Review. 20 years ago, single men accounted for the vast majority of illegal immigrants. Now families or minors are almost 60% of apprehensions. That's an important point, and I think it's been lost. Almost 60% of apprehensions are families or minors. Wow. Because of court-dictated rules limiting how long we can hold children, an anti-trafficking law that makes it impossible to easily send Central American minors home, and a broken asylum process on top of strained resources across the board, we are routinely releasing migrants into the country, even though this is a policy that the Trump administration rightly opposes and desperately wants to reverse. Our inability to control the flow encourages more migrants to come. More common sense. And President Trump knows that as well. And he had a message to the media, sort of broke his own news, if you will, about more of what National Review is describing as on the horizon, specifically another caravan forming.
You can all play cute, and I'd say 80% of you are possibly in coordination with the opposition party. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. All you have to do is look at the borders, rent a helicopter, except you don't want to know the truth, and watch. And by the way, here's the story. There is another major caravan forming right now in Honduras, and so far we're trying to break it up, but so far it's bigger than anything we've seen, and a drone isn't going to stop it, and a sensor isn't going to stop it, but you know what's going to stop it in its tracks? A nice powerful wall.
Congressman Chip Roy, a Republican from Texas, writing in The Federalist. Fences have worked since the dawn of time. We currently have 46 miles of reinforced fencing along the San Diego sector of the border. Before construction began in 1986, there were 629,656 arrests. Compare that to the 31,891 arrests in 2016. Boy, that's pretty...
That's significant.
I would say. At least
dropped it by more than half, if I'm doing the numbers right.
The fence is at least part of the reason. Fences are, in fact, a viable 21st century solution. Instead of bickering over what we know to be a reality, how about we just start? Let's start in Brownsville and work up the river. We'll clear cane where needed. We'll add a fence where needed. We'll make navigable roadways for Border Patrol along with cameras and radio towers. Will we encounter obstacles? Sure. If a rancher needs water, we'll leave an opening. Post a guard. Put up a working camera. Move a mile up the river and keep going. When you get to Big Bend, maybe we put up a fence, maybe we don't. But let's find a solution. It's time to acknowledge and declare our collective resolve that the era of lawless borders is over. I mean, pretty tangible, pretty commonsensical, not ideological.
So you say there's a new caravan.
And I think it's gonna be a long, long walk until I get to the United States. I'm not the man my passport says I am.
Oh, no.
I'm in the caravan.
Yeah. I got an idea. Let's help President Trump break up that caravan by blaring that song at the caravan as it's forming in Honduras. And that will repel them back to.
Like we get to see more Honduran flags.
There you go.
Hey, let me in your country because I'm holding a Honduran flag.
Eric in Park Ridge, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. How you doing?
Morning.
Well, I had an opinion on this, and I thought that it would be good for them to – I want Trump to stand his ground. And, if people are teetering either which way, what I mean by that is they're still undecided as to, like, how they want to see their way through with this. You know, like, people are right at that tipping point, you know, and he's got to lead us through and stand his ground and keep the government shut down and get that wall, you know, and show us the leadership to help guide us through our decision. You know what I mean?
All right. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Eric. You're in the Matt Gaetz camp, and I get it. I think that's the right position. David and McCook.
Hey, happy Friday, guys.
Hello.
Trump should definitely stand his ground. I was curious, did you hear what that pinhead Acosta did yesterday or the day before?
Yeah, I don't see any problem down here.
Right. Yeah, right by a fence.
Exactly.
What an idiot.
It was a great moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see a problem down here. Well, yeah, no duh, Mimbo.
I'm looking through this fence, and I don't see anybody right here.
Because there's a fence there, Mimbo. It was classic.
Oh, he's funny.
He's the only guy wearing a suit in McAllen, Texas, I'll tell you that much.
Expensive suit, too. He's big.
Well, you know, now that he's
big
single,
swing and D down
well,
there.
He got divorced, and he's on the prowl. Oh, that's gross.
He's a wolf of another sort. Bruno in Naperville.
Yeah, you know, Trump has given in on this issue twice before. If he caves this time, he's done in 2020. He has to understand he has nothing in common with the people that he's supposedly negotiating with because their goal is the demographic and cultural transformation of America into something that it never was. And they'll do anything to get there because for them, the ends justifies the means. And if the means involves people dying, if it involves drugs, if it involves overstressed social services, the depressed wages, unemployment, they don't care because they have one goal and one goal in mind. And that's what I said.
Thanks for the call, Bruno.
The only way to solve this, declare a national emergency, get the funding needed, get in the Army Corps of Engineers to construct the wall, and then end the government shutdown.
Or, I mean, if...
Because chucking in, everyone's digging in their heels. This shutdown could go on forever. And I do feel bad because I do know what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck. I feel bad. This one paycheck's fine, but come Saturday, this will be the longest shutdown ever.
It's a great blaring headline, but it's also 20 days, 22 days.
Yeah.
I mean,
I wouldn't want to work and not get paid.
Well, I understand. Like, nobody's suggesting that. Nobody's suggesting that. But well, that's the whole idea. Like, only this group is impacted. We're being impacted now. So now it's time to Mark Stein writing his blog.
What did he say?
Talking about Chuck and Nancy's performance on Tuesday night. Droned on about the government shutdown, which nobody gives a hoot about or even notices unless you're one of the furloughed. And a temporary break in non-essential government that exists only to provide government benefits and government security for its bureaucrats is a parody of a crisis. Oh, gee, the poor, bloated, staggering Leviathan has a bandaged finger. Back in the real world, three-quarters of the federal government cruises on, along with all the multiple alternative governments, state, county, municipal, school district. One thing America does not want for is government. It's like Payless Shoe Source. There'll be another one 200 yards down the road.
My friend's in D.C. right now. She said everyone's an Uber driver. Every Uber she's gotten into is a federal worker that's furloughed.
Yeah, I also...
Like, we got to make money, so...
I also note the story how happy hour is beginning earlier at D.C. bars.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It moved up happy hour. Why? Mike in Union.
Hey, good Mike. Morning.
Morning.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Although your recommendation for Rocket Man may repel some of the immigrants, I would make a recommendation that they play Little Led Zeppelin, proven effective to drag Manuel Noriega out of his compound down there.
That's right.
That would be my recommendation.
Was that Led Zeppelin they blared at Manuel at Noriega?
Yeah, they were. I think it was at the Knob 10. So I was digging it. So
that's great.
Hey, and
thanks, Mike.
Real quickly, we have Jim Acosta standing along the border wall saying, there's nothing to see here. Everything's fine.
And here are some of the steel slats that the president's been talking about right here. As you can see, yes, you can see through these slats to the other side of the U.S.-Mexico border. But as we're walking along here, we're not seeing any kind of imminent danger. There are no migrants trying to rush toward this fence here in the McAllen, Texas area. As a matter of fact, there are some other businesses behind me along this highway. There's a gas station, Burger King, and so on. But no sign of the national emergency that the president has been talking about. As a matter of fact, it's pretty tranquil down here.
Well, golly, then I guess we don't have a problem. That's some ace reporting from Jim Acosta. I mean, when the president says 80% of the D.C. press corps are working in collaboration with the Democrats, he ain't kidding. Oh, by the way, I guess these are just made up numbers. I guess this never happened, but Congressman Chip Roy from Texas notes in his piece in the Federalist that I previously referenced, since 2011 in Texas alone, 7 years, just in Texas, 175,000 illegal aliens have been charged with more than 437,000 criminal offenses. And they have also had another tragedy down there that gives form to this problem. Last summer in San Antonio, Representative Roy references, an illegal immigrant needlessly killed a young and vibrant Texan named Jared Vargas. Law enforcement apprehended the murderer multiple times but released him. His final release just days before he killed Jared Vargas. But I guess because Jim Acosta doesn't see anything in that little piece of turf that he's occupying on the border, we don't got a problem.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, Dan and Amy.
You want to try that again?
Yeah. Boy. Mike Pompeo, he's the Secretary of State, don't you know, gave a expansive speech in Cairo yesterday. And very interesting because he issued a frontal assault on the speech given in Cairo some 10 years ago by one President Barack Obama, and the policy choices that followed that speech, what they wrought, how the Trump administration has reversed the approach to the Middle East and to Islamofascism, and restored America's reputation and allegiances with those individuals and countries that are at least somewhat tolerant of political and religious pluralism. Listen to what Pompeo had to say. There's a lot here, but it's just a stark indictment of the 8 years of President Obama's foreign policy in the region.
Remember, it was here in this city, that another American stood before you. He told you that radical Islamist terrorism does not stem from an ideology. He told you that he told you that 9/11 led my country to abandon its ideals, particularly in the Middle East. He told you that the United States and the Muslim world needed, quote, a new beginning, end of quote. The results of these misjudgments have been dire. In falsely seeing ourselves as a force for what ails the Middle East, we were timid in asserting ourselves when the times and our partners demanded it. We grossly underestimated the tenacity and viciousness of radical Islamism, a debauched strain of the faith that seeks to upend every other form of worship or governance. ISIS drove to the outskirts of Baghdad as America hesitated. They raped and pillaged and murdered tens of thousands of innocents. They birthed the caliphate across Syria and Iraq and launched terror attacks that killed all across continents. America's reluctance, our reluctance to wield our influence, kept us silent as the people of Iran rose up against the mullahs in Tehran in the Green Revolution. The Ayatollahs and their henchmen murdered, jailed, and intimidated freedom-loving Iranians. And they wrongly blamed America for this unrest when it was their own tyranny that had fueled it. Emboldened, the regime spread its cancerous influence to Yemen, to Iraq, to Syria, and still further into Lebanon. Our penchant, America's penchant for wishful thinking, led us to look the other way as Hezbollah, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Iranian regime, accumulated a massive arsenal of approximately 130,000 rockets and missiles. They stored and positioned these weapons in Lebanese towns and villages in flagrant violation of international law. That arsenal is aimed squarely at our ally, Israel. When Bashar Assad unleashed terror upon ordinary Syrians and barrel-bombed civilians with sarin gas, a true echo of Saddam Hussein's gassing of the Kurdish people, we condemned his actions, but in our hesitation to wield power, we did nothing. Our eagerness to address only Muslims and not nations ignored the rich diversity of the Middle East and frayed old bonds. It undermined the concept of the nation state, the building block of international stability. And our desire for peace at any cost led us to strike a deal with Iran, our common enemy. So today, what did we learn from all of this?
Well, that's a pretty powerful review of that region and the choices that were made by the previous administration in it and what they begot. I thought Pompeo gave a great speech, and it's difficult to argue with the results he's describing from the choices that were made in Iran, in Syria, in the region generally. There's just some important notes there, speaking to Muslims only rather than the region, the individual nation states, the diversity of the populations of those countries. And think about those populations that were being persecuted in ISIS's heyday, like Coptic Christians in places like Egypt. Mm-hmm. Pompeo continued. What did we learn? Here's what we learned.
We learned that when America retreats, chaos often follows. When we neglect our friends, resentment builds. And when we partner with our enemies, they advance. The good news is this. The age of self-inflicted American shame is over. And so are the policies that produce so much needless suffering. Now comes the real new beginning.
The age of self-inflicted American shame is over. And some could take those words about abandoning our friends, retreating when our engagement is required, and say, well, isn't that what we're doing? In Syria, as yesterday, the troop drawdown, the withdrawal, started per the president's order. In Afghanistan as well. Isn't that what we're doing? But then you have to go back and look at all of the entanglements and what they've produced and what potential they have to produce. So I don't like even floating the silliness of relying on anything a radical Islamist like Erdogan in Turkey has to say. But when our own generals say there is no military solution to be had in Syria, well, then why are we going to risk, and the same thing could be said of Afghanistan, other than, you know, this negotiated withdrawal that we've been engaged in effecting, and the Taliban's reassume control of that country. So, on the one hand, you listen to Pompeo's words, and we need to be forceful where we enter. But where we've made mistakes, where we've drawn red lines that we don't intend to man, like we did in Syria under President Obama, then let's not extend those mistakes in perpetuity. We talked to Dr. Zudi Jasser from the American Islamic Forum for Democracy yesterday on the show. And I don't disagree with what he had to say about winning the peace and wanting some presence in Syria, not just to work in concert with our Kurdish allies, but also for intelligence gathering, as the Trump administration has dealt basically the kill shot to ISIS. It doesn't mean that we should have no presence there, and it doesn't mean we won't have any presence there on a limited intelligence oriented manner. And I think that's what Pompeo is getting to, and ultimately did get to when you know, he talked about this administration's posture. You've heard what happened. You've heard what we learned. What's the Trump administration doing about it, and how's that going?
The United States under President Trump has reasserted its traditional role as a force for good in this region. We've learned from our mistakes. We've rediscovered our voice. We've rebuilt our relationships. We've rejected false overtures from our enemies. And look at what we've accomplished. Look at what we've accomplished together. Under new leadership, America has confronted the ugly reality of radical Islamism. On President Trump's very first trip abroad to this region, he called on Muslim-majority nations to, quote, meet history's greatest test, to conquer extremism and vanquish the forces of terrorism. President Sisi joined us. He joined us in denouncing the twisted ideology which has brought death and suffering on so many. I thank President Sisi for his courage.
So now, considering what Pompeo has reviewed, and I think the persuasive nature of what he had to say, you still worried about President Trump wrecking America's standing in the world, leading us into world wars? Or do you have a sense that maybe the hand on the rudder, particularly per those surrounding him, like Pompeo, like Bolton, maybe it's a little bit more stable than the D.C. press corps would have you believe? And maybe the community organizer-in-chief that preceded President Trump, maybe he was the wrong individual to captain the ship.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy and...
Why are you shaking your head over there? What's going on?
I'm just sort of mystified by this development at the Vatican.
Well, yeah, they're getting together an Olympic team. They're getting together a track team. And they have Swiss guards, priests, nuns, pharmacists, and a 62-year-old professor who works in the Vatican's Apostolic Library. They're putting a team together, an Italian track. They'll run under with the Italian Track Association, but they're their own country.
I don't think the 62-year-old professor is going to be able to take out Usain Bolt. That's just a guess.
What do you think
the
odds are in Vegas? But yeah, they just decided. You know, they've decided that they need to compete in games, in organized sports, and games of the small states of Europe. They want to dominate. But the video, I mean, they came out with their new track suits yesterday. With the, you know, the Holy See flag patch. And it looks funny
exactly
because people...
Not exactly aerodynamic.
With the nun in the long skirt.
Right.
I mean, how is she going to kill it in that thing? So I think, you know, get rid of the habit too, maybe. I don't know.
I like the habit.
You think that'll be...
Well, it's just distinguishing. And it'll be like the coolest uniform since Flo-Jo.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's...
Remember?
Oh, I love Flo. Wasn't she gorgeous? And her nails. Remember that? And then she wore those beautiful suits. But her hair was always done beautifully.
And the one pant leg.
The one pant leg thing.
The one arm.
It was gorgeous.
So,
Team members, so they were wearing, Navy track suits, by the way. And they're the Vatican pharmacist, who is a runner. His name is Michele Caporetti. Said the aim of the team is not exclusively competitive, but rather to promote culture and running and launch the message of solidarity and the fight against racism and violence of all types. Just run, buddy.
Yeah. Well,
spare me your social justice warrior speech there. But no, and you know, in recent years, the Vatican has fielded unofficial football teams and a cricket team. So they're, you know, it helped forge relationships with the Anglican Church. Mm-hmm.
The Anglican Church?
Oh, my God. Did I say Anglican Church?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I need to go away.
Uh-huh.
So it should be, you know, the track team, they're the first to have legal status in Vatican City.
So I mean, I think Pope Julius II, you're the warrior pope. I don't think like Pope Francis is going to be the Olympics pope.
Yeah.
this is bizarre.
You know what? They should bring him out in opening ceremonies. So Vatican City, then he comes out, and then the team comes out behind him. That's a brilliant idea, Dan.
Well, I mean,
ceremonies, if they make it. Well, they
you will know whose side God is on in those competitions. I mean, that's the whole, when they...
So I joked around, flying nuns, running nuns, and it's the God squad.
Yeah, true. Let's say it'd be, who's the flying nun? Sally Field. Yeah. Come to life. Boy... When this team says Our Lady of Victory, pray for us. I mean,
scusi, babbida boopy, che cosa?
Peter, what are you doing?
Speaking Italian, babbida boopy, babbida boopida babbida babbida.
Peter, you can't speak Italian just because you have a mustache.
Boopida babba, boopa bibi boopa babba bibi babba.
Tu sei un pazzo, va bene qui.
Boopi babba.
Sono stanco di te. Ti do un pugno alla testa. Uccido con questa carne.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity. Right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So four candidates for mayor are on your airwaves, television airwaves at least. You got your Chico, you got your Preckwinkle, you got your Mendoza, you got your Daley. But there's another dozen candidates that are doing the candidate forums and social media and getting around the city. And again, in a field this crowded, in a race where maybe 15% of the vote gets you into the runoff to April, it does have the possibility that a surprise could be in the offing, particularly as the city is in such bad shape and people are looking for something qualitatively different. I think a lot of people are, thus the number of candidates, not to mention just the idea of an open seat for mayor in Chicago is something that happens once a millennia or so.
Yeah, once in our lifetime.
So we're trying to get as many of the candidates, all the candidates who are willing to come on the show to discuss the issues and their plans and their candidacy, give them some time to do that as we roll towards the February 26th primary. And next up on the list is Dorothy Brown. She is the longtime clerk of the Circuit Court of Cook County. I believe she was elected in 2000. And
yesterday she made news because James Allen, the Board of Election Commissioner, says that she needs to prove that the 12,500 signatures are legitimate. That thousands of the names she submitted were suddenly and mysteriously ruled invalid.
Well, that's where we start. Is Dorothy Brown going to make the ballot, which needs to be printed fairly soon because of this petition challenge? Dorothy Brown, Cook County Circuit Court Clerk, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So where does that petition challenge stand? How confident are you that you're going to survive that, rehabilitate the signatures you need to, and be on the ballot come February 26th?
Well, there'll be a status hearing on today, and we feel really good. A lot of great volunteers, and so we're going to they had, you know, people that really don't understand how to read signatures and that sort of thing, because just some of their staff, people that they hired off the street, actually ruling on signatures that and how it looks. I mean, my signature has changed in the last 20 years. Sometimes most people haven't updated their voter registration cards, but they couldn't figure out if the person was registered. They printed their name, and they couldn't figure out if the signature was proper. So there's going to be a handwriting expert that's paid for by the Chicago Board of Election that will go back and review those things that people ruled that the signature was not genuine, even though the person was registered at that address.
But you turned in 25,000 signatures to get on the ballot. So how did this happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, the thing that I talked about yesterday is the fact that Cook County actually controls and has access to the Chicago Board of Election system because they're joint systems. And when my numbers started to change, that they added a new 2,000 objections at the last minute, almost 2,000, I would say it was 1,700, at the last minute, this past Monday, as a matter of fact, after we had been reviewing signatures for a month, I said that there's something awry with that. The potential for fraud, they should have restricted access immediately to Cook County when the County Board President, who the technology department at Cook County reports to, became a candidate in this race. But that's, you know, so that's what we're dealing with, the potential for fraud and that sort of thing. So, you know, we're just moving forward, dealing with the issues and how we're going to, you know, bring change to Chicago.
Yeah, one final note on the signature issue. I saw this online video from Neil, is it Seals Griffin? Is that his name?
Sales
Griffin, the entrepreneur, young guy, tech entrepreneur who's running for mayor. And he made the point, because he was the subject of a petition challenge too, that the checkers ruled his mom's signature invalid. Oh. And he's like, I'm pretty sure it was my mom who signed my petition. That's a fair point.
These people are connected. These people that they've hired, they're connected. They actually, were telling me that they were saying that people were telling them, oh, Dorothy Brown will be all right, even if you don't rule in her favor. And then one person indicated to me that Ricky Hinton from the Willie Wilson campaign, because, you know, I have two challenges, actually said that he paid some people to put some bad signatures within my
set of signatures. That doesn't sound like Hollywood Hendon. All right, so let's talk about your candidacy. Let's assume you'll be on the ballot. And so what's the reason that Dorothy Brown is a candidate for mayor?
Well, the reason why I made the decision to run for mayor of the city of Chicago, because I just felt, and I continue to feel, that, you know, our educational system needs to be at a high quality. Education is my number one thing, because I feel that if we can properly educate all of our children, then they will have an alternative to crime. They'll be able to get good jobs. And so the education was my number one thing. And also I looked at the fact that, you know, this city has been a strangled hold by the political machine for far too long. And we need someone that is independent, like myself. I'm an independent Democrat. I'm unbought and I'm unbossed. And we need someone that has the background, experience, and the heart. I mean, this is not an oratorical competition. This is not a comedy routine. You know, we had a lot of people doing that on last night. This is about someone that can actually manage this city and be fair and have, make sure that it's equitable to all of the citizens. I'm an attorney, and I can handle the legal lawmaking body of the city council. A lot of people do not realize that. I'm also a CPA and an MBA. Now, there are not many people who have passed the CPA exam and the bar exam. And so with my financial acumen, I can bring a vision and lead the city into financial stability. So I can handle the finances of the city. And then, of course, I feel that I have the heart. You can have the background and an experience, but if you don't have the heart to actually make sure that things are fair for everyone, then you won't, things will not get done properly for everyone. And so from the heart standpoint, I came from a very humble beginning. My mother was a cook and a domestic worker. My father was a laundry worker and a cotton farmer. And he took me and my seven siblings to the cotton fields. And then I worked in a factory. See, I came from a very humble beginning, so I respect the least to the greatest. I came up very hard, and everything I've ever gotten, I had to earn it and earn it the hard way. So I know how to respect people. So that's why I want to put the hope back in the eyes of these young people that I see, for instance, hanging out on the streets of the West Side and looking at that economic development that hasn't changed since 1968. Yeah. And so it's a travesty. We can do better. We must shift the paradigm of how things are done here in the city of Chicago.
Yeah, last night you were at the forum, you and 13 other candidates. Tony Preckwinkle, a no-show. Do you also feel that she should step down because of her connection to Alderman Ed Burke?
Well, absolutely. And I think that she should actually withdraw her petition challenge to me, just given the fact that her office has the ability, has had the ability and continue to have the ability to make changes to the petition challenge system that the city is using. I can't understand why they would not have understood that needed to be a block, that there should have been a firewall put up between Cook County and the city of Chicago. They can make changes to each other's system. They started using a joint system in 2011. And so it's really, she's kind of our president. She hasn't done a good job there either, because she was the first county board president where we actually had to lay people off, where they had to go and probably file bankruptcy, lose their homes. Back in 2010, that was the first year, and I had been in office for 10 years at that point. I actually had to lay people off, a county board president that could not figure it out. Then the sugar pop tax, just all those things that she's done and just really hasn't done very well. It's a smoke and mirrors administration.
You're, as you mentioned, CPA, MBA, attorney. So you understand balance sheets. You're a green eye shades person. So what do we do?
Haven't heard that in a while.
Well, yeah, I'm very old. What
he's 90.
What do we do about $40 billion in unfunded pension liabilities? We got $1 billion balloon payment next year, and that's just to sort of maintain status quo, which is not maintainable for much longer. So what do we do about police and fire pensions?
Well, I say that, you know, first of all, I'm not interested in changing, amending the Constitution to take away the right for people to be able to retire and be able to have and be in a position to take care of themselves. And so I'm going to, first of all, develop a long-term strategic plan for financial stability for the city as a whole in the long run, short-term and long-term. And then I want to evaluate the revenue streams that we already have in, because I feel that we're probably not actually collecting in the way that we should. We need to have better controls in place and ensure we actually are collecting the money that from the fees that we already have. And then I want to propose some new revenue streams. I have a proposal of actually having a city-sponsored lottery that is technology-based, whereby people can actually buy my lottery tickets anywhere in the world. And I feel that that would bring a significant amount of funds in. And it's a shorter-term fix than building a casino. I'm fine with building having a city casino where we are actually earning the funds. And I'm also fine with legalizing marijuana, but I think that we have to actually have some more creative ideas even small and large cities, are raising funds as well, because we have to do everything that we can to stabilize and fund the pension for these for workers that have worked too hard, and we have to give them their health care back, those retirees their health care back.
Well, so the issue of the endemic corruption in the city of Chicago has been raised with an exclamation point with Ed Burke's indictment. And, you know, you and your office have been subject to some federal inquiries over your time as Cook County Circuit Court clerk as well. Address some of the questions about the ethical conduct of your office over the years that are certainly going to be re-raised as a candidate for mayor.
Yeah, Dan. So, you know, it's interesting because when I read some of the information, I didn't know where that came from, but I finally, after 2 years, got some insight to that situation. And these were individuals that I fired when I first got in office from the prior administration. They actually came after me in 2004. And when I looked, and there was a newspaper article in 2004 where they talked about some kind of fundraising scheme and that sort of thing. And the same information was in the some information I received from that I saw from the federal government. And I said, oh, these are the same individuals. They have been after me for a long time. And I actually called for the federal government to actually charge them with perjury. Anytime you tell an FBI agent an inaccuracy, that is actually perjury. You do not have to go before a grand jury. So all of those things are untrue. If I was taking the kind of money they were talking about, then I would probably not be trying to raise money or have the process. I would have the money to actually have the campaign that, and but I would be on television as well. I have no money. So this, you know, they said I was taking funds for jobs. My jobs, my Shacklin jobs, were actually, and they were Shacklin jobs, they actually are selected through the computer. And so it was just blatant lies and trying to find ways to taint me and my administration.
And so, as far as you know, you are not a target at present of any federal investigation, as far as you know.
I have not. They have not talked to me. You know, I could have been the target because I was the person that these individuals were actually trying to go after.
But you've never spoken to the FBI.
I've never spoken to them, and I'm sure that they have found out by now that I did nothing wrong. They took my phone as well back in 2015 and gave it back, and they did not find any texts that were discriminatory. You know, that's where people actually, you know, text information. They didn't find any emails that were discriminatory. They haven't taped me saying anything discriminatory that was illegal. And so I have operated at the highest of integrity. That's how my parents raised me, and that's how I would continue to do. People will come after you, but you have to fight, and that's the same fight I'm going to bring to the city of Chicago.
All right. She is Dorothy Brown. Dorothy, where can people get more information about your candidacy, website?
DorothyForMayor.com. They can go on my website and see information concerning my positions. Like me on Facebook also, and what I've been doing, Dan and Amy, I've been doing a countdown every day or evening or later in the evening at night. I actually do a Facebook Live, and we've been doing a countdown. We'll do a countdown until February 26th for the election day, mm-hmm. and we talk about what happened that day and different parts of my platform.
I'm doing a countdown as well to my retirement in Naples, but it's a little bit different. Dorothy Brown.
He's tweeting it instead of Facebooking.
Candidate for mayor, clerk of circuit court, Cook County. Dorothy, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you.
Always good to catch up, Dorothy. Thank you so much. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's morning answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy had to depart for the final half of the show on a personal matter, but she'll be back Monday. So I'm left to try and tackle Brett Baer all by myself. I'll do my best. President Trump addressing the assembled D.C. press corps yesterday before making his way down to McAllen, Texas. And you want to play the anecdote game with President Trump, do you, D.C. press corps? There's human pain on one side, federal employees missing a paycheck. And it's not to be discounted. That's an uncomfortable position. You have empathy for anybody that is in financial straits, right? But there's another source of human pain that the D.C. press corps is less interested to discuss, and that's where the president interceded.
Well, you know who has more human pain? The parents of people who had children killed by an illegal immigrant that should have never been in the country. You know who has more human pain? The husband that lost the wife, or the wife that lost the husband to an illegal immigrant that came in five or six times that shouldn't be here.
And one of those individuals who knows all about that human pain, Reggie Singh, he's the brother of fallen Newman, California police officer Ranil Singh. And you'll remember Reggie's, he was at the press conference after law enforcement in California made an arrest in his brother's murder. You ready for some human pain? Not to be exploitive, but to provide some balance? Reggie on December 28th.
I wish I could thank all the law enforcement agencies, Homeland Security in San Francisco, everyone, Bakersfield team. I was waiting for this to happen. I'd like to thank you, working day and night, to make this happen.
And Reggie and his brother O'Neill are legal immigrants from Fiji, emigrated to this country legally. Reggie sat down with Martha McCallum at Fox this week, and he had this to say about the president's position and what he'd like to see done so families like his don't have to endure the pain that he is enduring.
If he would have been deported, my brother would be alive right now. I would not be doing this interview. What I truly feel about this is, you know, if we make our immigration law stricter, if we take action and not allow an illegal immigrant to get second chance, I think that, you know, we could minimize the crime rate we are having.
For more on this and other issues, we got Beto, the border, press corps, Manafort, Trump Jr., Cohen. We got a lot to cover, so let's get right to it. We're pleased to be joined again by Brett Baer, the anchor of Special Report, 5 p.m. Chicago time, weekdays, of course, and the book again, 3 Days in Moscow, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of the Soviet Empire. Brett, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Morning.
Morning. So, you know, just picking up on the shutdown. Partial shutdown and plus the border security issue. The president reiterated yesterday that he believes he has the absolute right to declare a national emergency. And if Pelosi and Schumer continue to be unreasonable from his point of view, that he is inclined to do that. Do you see anything, even what was floated yesterday, the idea of restarting DACA as a possibility to get Pelosi and Schumer off the dime to reach some accord, or are we going to the President Trump taking we're going to the President taking executive action?
I think it's the latter. There was hope at the beginning of the week, midweek, that Lindsey Graham was going to be able to cobble together some coalition to do some compromise. Frankly, Democrats are not moving. They're not moving off of no. At all. So I don't think it's going to move, but we'll see. I mean, today is the first day that the paychecks have not gone out. So the whole thing ratchets up about five notches. And once you get through the weekend and Monday, you'll be seeing all kinds of different reports about, you know, people not getting their paychecks. And, you know, what that all means. So the pressure mounts up. I think Democrats wanted to get to this point. This is my thought, and just from informed talking on Capitol Hill to
people up there, lobbyists, lawmakers, both sides of the aisle. And they think that this is a leverage point for them. I also sat in that off the record at the White House with President Trump. And I got the sense that he's not moving off this. So either somebody comes forward with some piece of compromise legislation, and he's ready to sign basically anything that gets his border security, you know, stepped up.
Yeah, I mean, Matt,
either that,
I'm sorry,
or he's going to do the national emergency, and I think probably the latter as we look at the landscape.
Yeah, there's been a lot of opining about whether, you know, the politics of this and whether or not this is you know, politically advantageous for the president as he eyes 2020, or the Democrats as they eye 2020, and, you know, pouring over the polls. But I thought Matt Gaetz from Florida, congressman from Florida, said something interesting, just relaying to Lou Dobbs this anecdote of a conversation he apparently had with the president, where the president said to him, according to him, that, look, I'm going to the mat on this, and if I die, I'm going to die with my boots on. And, you know, was that important to his campaign? I think he understands it. It seems to me that it's that important to his success or failure as a president, at least in his first term, and that there is not going to be any, you know, walk away, we'll open the government and continue talking type of concession by the president.
Yeah. And the crazy part is that Democrats have such an opportunity. They could get so much stuff that they really wanted to get. If there's any president who could get it across the finish line for some comprehensive or at least semi-comprehensive immigration reform bill, this is the one.
Right.
This is your chance. I mean, if you want DACA, if you want, I don't know, you know, all the kind of technology on the border, if you want some change to the law as far as asylum seekers, to make it easier for some, to make it tougher for others, all of that could be in. This is a guy who, once he signs on to a piece of legislation, can really move numbers as far as votes, and yet they haven't even put one counteroffer on the table.
What's the feeling at the White House and in the upper reaches of the Republican caucuses on the Hill about the developments this week with Manafort, with the suggestion that Trump Jr. will be subpoenaed, and that, of course, yesterday Michael Cohen scheduled to testify before Congress on February 7th. What's the feeling about the state of play in the collusion investigation?
I think the feeling is that it's probably before the end of the month, something is going to happen. You know, whether it's more indictments, whether it's the actual Mueller report. There's a lot of on both sides of the aisle questioning of, you know, what's the timeline, and we've been dealing with that for several weeks, but it feels like it's coming to a head. I said it was going to be before February back in December, and I think it's still that way. And as far as the other investigations, you know, the House is going to step up, and once you start getting these people testifying in public, then you have a president who will react to what's on TV, and it won't be good.
Right. If what you say does come to pass, it makes for, oh boy, will that be a raucous State of the Union address at the end of the month?
Exactly.
That will not be a pro forma State of the Union.
No, and just think about the image there. I mean, it's whatever the president is going to say about all of that, and Nancy Pelosi's over his right shoulder.
I also wanted to know if you'll be live streaming your next teeth cleaning. I think our listeners are interested in that. We're fascinated by, you know, our betters like Beto O'Rourke and the mundanities of their lives. We want to see that Facebook Live. We want to see everything they're doing every moment. What do you make of that and what that portends for political coverage in 20?
You know.
Okay, I think that about says it all right there.
I think I was talking to people about it last night, and you know, I think that's jumping the shark. I mean, once you have the thing sucking the saliva out of your mouth as you're live doing the Instagram, and you're sharing that moment, he's already been sharing, like, cooking dinner, you know. So it's sort of like the Truman Show, right? And at some totally. Point, you jump the shark, and people say, okay, this is enough. I think that might have been yesterday. The Twitter response was quite something. Twitter is a dark place. Sometimes you look at my Twitter feed, it can be very, very dark, but it's also funny. And once that meme came out of him doing that, some guy said, oh, no, I can't believe it, and I really don't want to see Bernie Sanders' colonoscopy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and like with virtual reality games now, I mean, you could be like the doctor. You really get your hand up in there. You know, I mean, that could be a real sort of interactive experience. Wouldn't that be fun?
Moon River.
Scott, using the whole hand, Doc? All right, prepare. And I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I picked the right place to sojourn over the holidays. I ran into one Brett Baer at Naples National playing the group behind him. And I mean, Brett, I'll let you tell the story because I know it was life changing for you. Tell him about the tell him about the drive that I hit with you as my witness.
I tell you what, he piped a drive right down the middle. And what I have to say is that obviously you are not spending a lot of time you know, behind the microphone, because there's a lot of practice going on there. That game looks pretty strong.
The show ends at 9. I'm out at 9:01. I tee off about 9:45. Yeah.
You got a good swing, man. We have to play sometime.
Yeah, definitely. I know you're a good player. It was fun to see you, and fun as always to have you. Brett Baer, special report, 5 p.m. Chicago time. The book, again, you want to pick up, 3 Days in Moscow, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of the Soviet Empire. Brett, thanks for joining us. And he joined us on turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan. And boy, I tell you, a couple of stories out of Florida that could easily, and you would expect to be, originating in Illinois, about the lack of accountability and the second and third and infinite number of chances people in public office get no matter their performance. I'm talking about Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel, and I'm talking about Broward County Election Supervisor Brenda Snipes. Yeah. The sheriff who presided over the Parkland school shooting. And the election supervisor who presided over this latest recount this last November, right, with the DeSantis race, the governor's race, and Scott against Nelson, the Senate race. Not exactly on the stick in terms of votes being counted in a timely fashion, transparency in disclosing how many votes were left to be counted and when that was happening. Well, Wednesday this week, a federal judge appointed by Barack Obama, District Judge Mark Walker, specifically ruled that the newly inaugurated governor, DeSantis, should be afforded a meaningful opportunity to be heard, quote unquote, regarding her suspension by outgoing Governor Rick Scott. She was suspended by the governor, by Scott, for multiple violations of Florida law, incompetence and neglect of duty. Those are all materially obvious. She filed suit trying to get reinstated, and now there's yet another bureaucratic process that she's going to be afforded, a hearing process she's going to be afforded, even though she was an executive appointee. I don't know what the federal government has to do in this sort of personnel matter. She was appointed by Jeb Bush. So we'll continue to follow Brenda Snipes because, you know, Broward County and the state of Florida in 2020 could be important. I'm just saying. And then Scott Israel. Scott Israel. You remember Scott Israel and some of his famous interviews, like the one with Jake Tapper after that horror in Parkland about what a great job he's doing.
There needed to be a report, and that's what we're looking into, that a report needed to be completed. It needed to be forwarded to our either Homeland Security or Violent Crimes Unit, and they would have followed up on
it. That's from your notes. That's from notes released by your office. I'm not making this up. This is from Broward.
No, and that's what that the officer who handled that is on restrictive duty, and that's an active internal investigation, and we are looking into it. I can't tell you, I can't predict how an investigation's going, but I've exercised my due diligence. I've led this county proudly, as I always have. We have restricted that deputy as we look into it. Their deputies make mistakes, police officers make mistakes, we all make mistakes, but it's not the responsibility of the general or the president if you have a deserter. You look into this, we're looking into this aggressively, and we'll take care of it, and justice will be served.
Mm-hmm. Boy, doesn't it sound like Illinois? The buck stops somewhere else.
Are you really not taking any responsibility for the multiple red flags that were brought to the attention of the Broward Sheriff's Office about this shooter before the incident, whether it was people near him, close to him, calling the police on him?
Jake, I could only take responsibility for what I... about. I exercise my due diligence. I've given amazing leadership to this agency.
Amazing leadership?
I've worked... Yes, Jake. There's a lot of things we've done throughout this. You don't measure a person's leadership by a deputy not going into a. These deputies received the training they needed.
Maybe you measure somebody's leadership by whether or not they protect the community. In this case, you've listed 23 incidents before the shooting involving the shooter, and still, nothing was done to keep guns out of his hands, to make sure that the school was protected, to make sure you were keeping an eye on him. Your deputy at the school failed. I don't understand how you can sit there and claim amazing leadership.
Jake, on 16 of those cases, our deputies did everything right. Our deputies have done amazing things. We've taken this, in the 5 years I've been sheriff, we've taken the Broward Sheriff's Office to a new level. I work with some of the bravest people I've ever met. One person at this point, one person didn't do what he should have done.
Sort of an amazing statement to make with 17 dead children in the wake, talking about how great you are, the amazing work you've done. Why don't we focus on the good things, not the dead bodies at Parkland High School? At the high school in Parkland, I should say. Stoneman Douglas. DeSantis, the incoming governor, the rumor is that he's going to suspend Israel. And then probably Israel will file the same Brenda Snipes lawsuit in federal court, and he'll get another hearing and another hearing. It's tough to remove people from government. Think about that during the partial shutdown.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy will be back on Monday. Doubting Jim Acosta doesn't see migrants trying to enter this country illegally, is it really happening? Jim Acosta, live from outside McAllen, Texas.
And here are some of the steel slats that the president's been talking about right here. As you can see, yes, you can see through these slats to the other side of the U.S.-Mexico border. But as we're walking along here, we're not seeing any kind of imminent danger. There are no migrants trying to rush toward this fence here in the McAllen, Texas area. As a matter of fact, there are some other businesses behind me along this highway. There's a gas station, Burger King, and so on. But no sign of the national emergency that the president has been talking about. As a matter of fact, it's pretty tranquil down here.
Setting aside the fact that Jim Acosta is saying these things standing next to a fence for a moment, maybe they just didn't want to be on CNN. But here's the thing. Chip Roy, who's a congressman from Texas, writing in the Federalist, Federalist.com, since 2011 in Texas alone, 175,000 illegal aliens have been charged with more than 437,000 criminal offenses. And he also recounts a particularly tragic incident, which sort of gives form to at least one of the issues, which is violent crime. Last summer in San Antonio, an illegal immigrant needlessly killed a young and vibrant Texan, named Jared Vargas. Law enforcement apprehended the murderer multiple times, but released him. His final release just days before he killed Jared. And that's sort of what President Trump is talking about. The Jim Acosta type reporting, the effort to conceal or gaslight the American public into thinking that all of the data that we know from these law enforcement agencies is what just made up. President Trump getting a little frustrated at the press gaggle before he headed down to the border yesterday, and also broke a little bit of news about the nature of this ongoing humanitarian crisis with more migrants, another caravan forming.
You can all play cute, and I'd say 80% of you are possibly in coordination with the opposition party. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. All you have to do is look at the borders, rent a helicopter, except you don't want to know the truth, and watch. And by the way, here's the story. There is another major caravan forming right now in Honduras. And so far, we're trying to break it up. But so far, it's bigger than anything we've seen. And a drone isn't going to stop it. And a sensor isn't going to stop it. But you know what's going to stop it in its tracks? A nice, powerful wall.
Going back to Chip Roy's piece in The Federalist, he offers, fences have worked since the dawn of time. We currently have 46 miles of reinforced fencing along the San Diego sector of the border. Before construction began in 1986, there were 629,000 plus arrests. Compare that to the 31,000 plus arrests in 2016. Fences are, in fact, a viable 21st century solution. All right, well, let's get an expert opinion on the topic. We're pleased to be joined next by Mark Morgan, who is the former Customs and Border Protection Agency chief under President Obama. Mark, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Glad to be here.
So the data that's being offered by the president, offered by him on Tuesday night, the data you heard me recount from Congressman Roy's commentary, I mean, is that the truth of it? Do we have this humanitarian crisis? The nature of the migrants is different. It's not single men so much as it is families. And the combination of resources at the border plus the laws that are in effect in terms of how Border Patrol must handle the individuals trying to enter this country is really presenting all the problems that the president has been laying out for, lo, these many months.
That's correct. And everything that you just said in the opening, you're absolutely 100% everything you just said. The president of the United States is also absolutely correct in everything he's saying. Back in 2016, when I was chief of the Border Patrol, I was saying the same thing. I was saying we have a humanitarian crisis as well as a national security crisis. And that was back in 2016. I would say that you could argue that on both of those fronts, it's gotten worse, not better. So when he says that this is a humanitarian and national security crisis, I'm telling you, he is absolutely correct. And keep in mind, that's not just from my time as chief of the United States Border Patrol, and we can discuss that further. But I also did 2 decades in the FBI. Mm-hmm. And part of that time, I led the FBI's office in the El Paso division, the really only division in the FBI that's truly a border office. I mean, from my window seat in my office, I could see Juarez. And what's real and what's not manufactured is the warring cartels. They're warring with each other. They're killing each other. And why are they doing that? They're doing it because they're fighting for the human trafficking routes. They're doing that for the drug routes. They're doing that for the illegal immigration routes. That's a lie. That's real. And that's not manufactured.
Nancy Pelosi says, well, look, if you build a wall, they'll just tunnel under it El Chapo style. So there's no point to it. How do you react to that?
I know, right. I mean, I've got to believe, and I do believe, the American people they see through that and it's surety to that. So here's the thing. So go to the experts. Go to the United States Border Patrol agents that have been risking their lives, by the which 127 to date have died defending our borders and on the front line. Go to them, the experts that do it and live it every single day. Stop listening to political pundits that haven't spent 2 minutes on the border, let alone 2 decades, as some of these Border Patrol agents have done, risking their lives. Go to them and ask them. Tunnels. Let's just take a look at that. Tunnels. Are there tunnels? Yes. Have they been effective at times? Yes. But my question is so because the wall, as part of a multi-layer approach of infrastructure, technology, and personnel, because it could get defeated in some ways, we just don't do it? I mean, that's ridiculous. In San Diego that you just talked about, absolutely, there's areas of secondary and tertiary level of wall, of fencing, along with technology and personnel. If you look at that, it is absolutely historical proven data where the immigration, illegal immigration went down by 90%. Violent crime, all crime almost went away on both sides. Metropolitan areas have thrived again. But guess what? In the same area, there's still tunnels. So yeah, the bad guys are going to constantly change their tactics and procedures. But that doesn't mean the wall won't be effective. That doesn't mean the wall won't drastically reduce illegal immigration and other really bad things coming through the borders. We'll continue to increase our technology, the ground sensors, and getting better and better with that. But to say that there could be something that it could be defeated, therefore let's not do it. Right? I mean, that's absurd.
Yeah, I hear you. And Congressman Crenshaw down in Texas said the same thing. Could tunnels be built? And yeah, at some point somebody will probably notice them. And so, right, there's always going, I mean, the Pelosi argument is the argument to have no laws whatsoever because there's a law against murder. Somebody commits a murder. Well, then that's not working. So let's repeal the law.
Exactly.
I wanted to get your take, too. The response to the murder of Newman, California police officer Ranil Singh by a person in this country illegally, the response from the left has been to say, well, that's, you know, it's tragic, but it's anecdotal. So essentially, it's not really a problem. And that sort of got under Trump's skin yesterday, too, basically saying the Democrats don't give a damn about crime. I mean, what about the sort of lack of coverage, as much empathy as being heaped in the direction of federal employees missing a paycheck? The D.C. press corps, many politicians sort of don't want to confront the reality of events like the murder of Ranil Singh, it seems to me.
Exactly. And I tell you, so remember, I was hired as chief under President Obama. President Trump removed me as chief. And I want that to sink in for a second. And so I'm here today. President Trump, his administration removed me as chief. And I'm here today, and I've been speaking out to tell you that he's right. And what he's doing in all areas of border security, he's right. To include, when I see him speak, and he is outraged, the fact that any American has died at the hands of illegal immigrant, especially a police officer, especially Officer Singh's story, right? The fact that everyone is not equally outraged, that says a lot of where we're at in this country. And in my opinion, it's saying that we are looking at the facts and we are looking at this very difficult problem through our individual political ideological lens instead of looking at it through facts and with compassion. How can that not move you? You know, I was on the show, Laura Ingraham, last night, and I was so impressed with her because as she's talking to a family, a mother and father whose son had been killed by illegal immigrant, it was real. She was getting emotional. And I said, every American here should get emotional. And my question to the Democrats are, you know, I don't want to be political. My question to anybody who's not moved by that, who doesn't see that as a crisis, is how many? How many is enough? How many American citizens that are going to die at the hands of illegal immigrant is enough? 1, 2, 3, 4? I mean, stop me. It's thousands. And right now we're saying that we have a strategy that we know works and we can prove it works, of which a wall is an integral part of that multi-layered infrastructure, technology, and personnel approach. It works, and we're saying that it's absolutely going to dramatically reduce that type of strategy, and we got people that say, no, we don't need it.
Well,
I get it.
Yeah, and the whole talking point of some politicians that, you know, it's a very small fraction of persons here illegally that go on to commit other violent crimes. Yeah, true. It's the same argument they use about Islamofascists, Islamic-inspired terrorists. It's a very small fraction of Muslims around the world. Well, yeah, that's true. But here's the thing. A small fraction of a big number is a big problem.
Absolutely. And again, I do believe the American people are smarter than that to see through that argument. That, okay, so the argument is because a small percentage of the illegal immigrants are committing these heinous crimes, then what? We don't do anything about it?
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, that's absurd. No, what we're saying is, yeah, we got it. And here's another thing. If you go to the United States Border Patrol, those same agents, the same 127 agents have died protecting our borders, the same agents that are saying that, yes, a wall works, you know what those agents are going to say as well? They're going to say, we don't want to stop good people from coming in. No, we don't want that. What's ironic about a lot of these Border Patrol agents, they're from other countries as well. A lot of them are Mexican nationals. Many of them have spouses in Mexico or other countries, and they still have families there. So the irony is unbelievable, which is not being reported. But no, they're not saying that. What they're saying is, hey, look, we understand that a small amount of illegal immigrants commit these crimes. So what we're saying is, but we have a solution that we feel strongly and can show you with data that will dramatically reduce those people from getting in the country.
I wanted to get just any insights you care to offer about your time in the Obama administration and conversations like the one we're having internally during your time as the Customs and Border Protection chief. As President Trump has mentioned before, a lot of these Democrats, including former President Obama, previously supported border security funding, including for the wall, talked about the need to make sure that we have a secure southern border, that we know who is coming into this country and what they intend to do when they get here. I mean, for decades, back to Bill Clinton and then Barack Obama, Chuck Schumer, President Trump has made this point. But what was it like in the Obama administration? Do you sense a real shift in Democrat political positioning on this issue as compared to just a few years ago when you were the chief?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And look, you don't have to listen to me. Go back in history and look at a couple of things that are factual. And that's what I try to do. Let's take the individual political ideology out of it. Let's look at facts. And let's listen to what people said. So go back to 2006 and look at everybody across both aisles, right? A bipartisan approach. Everybody was supporting border security. They supported building a wall. They called the defense. It's a wall. Come on. It's semantics. A wall, physical barrier, fence. It's ridiculous. It's absurd that we're delineated what's immoral or not by what you call it. Let's look at the fact. In 2006, the Secure Fence Act, a bipartisan bill that was passed, everybody on both sides of the aisle were saying this is an issue. We have to stop illegal immigration. We have to stop bad people from coming in and doing bad things. We have to stop the flow of drugs. It's getting into our cities all throughout this country. That was back in 2006. The same stuff that they were saying on a bipartisan approach that led to the 2006 Secure Fence Act that resulted in 700 miles of wall being built is the same thing that's being said now by the current administration, and it's being rejected by the same people that supported it then. It's absurd. It's a travesty, and this is absolutely a political issue, and the American people are suffering because of it.
He is Mark Morgan, former U.S. Customs and Border Protection Chief during the Obama administration. Mark, thanks so much for joining us, providing your insights. Appreciate it.
You bet. Anytime.
Thank you. And you joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
What's the big deal in...
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and you got to read this guy. We've had him on the show before. Crispin Sartwell, he's an associate professor of philosophy at Dickinson College. His book is Entanglements, A System of Philosophy. And he's penned another good op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this week about Facebook. He poses the question, Mark Zuckerberg or Chinese President Xi Jinping, who do you choose? He chooses Zuckerberg, and he'll explain why. Crispin Sartwell, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good to be here, Dan.
So what's worse than Facebook? And your answer is the Chinese government. It's a pretty low bar or high bar, depending on your perspective. But why do you choose Zuckerberg over President Xi?
Well, okay. I mean, this is the people have been freaking out about social media companies and Facebook, Apple, Google, et cetera. And I think we should be worried about them in various ways. And, you know, what's happening to our information and, you know, then also the disinformation and so on that comes through these platforms and stuff. But I think that sort of obviously the biggest threat on the internet is governments, okay, in terms of hacking, in terms of launching viruses, in terms of surveillance, in terms of disinformation, all right? So, and the obvious model of it is the Chinese government now, which is really instituted an extent of control over communications that's unprecedented, and is, you know, generating this social credit system where they're monitoring all your communications and rating your conformity and rewarding or penalizing you for it. Now, that strikes me as a much greater kind of threat overall than anything Facebook or Google could do with your information.
Right. And so this is and this is relevant. Of course, we've had the hearings with the various social media CEOs, including Zuckerberg last year.
Yes.
And you know, people are rightly concerned about privacy and
indeed
and contract integrity. You know, you say you're doing this, but you're or not doing this,
yes,
but you're not being honest with me. So we understand.
Absolutely.
We should understand Facebook, Twitter, et cetera. We're the product. But you're suggesting it's better that we're the product privately than it is we're the product from the state's perspective.
Yeah, roughly. I mean, you know, I think we need to be concerned with both, and we definitely need to be concerned with the intersection of the two. So that, you know, I think that you're going to see more and more regulation of Facebook and, you know, other such companies. And then almost a merger of this kind of, you know, surveillance apparatus and personal information gathering apparatus. And, you know, so, I mean, the other thing is that Zuckerberg really has seemed quite incompetent, okay?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He's kind of this vague tech boy. They're always seem to be a year behind the problems that they're generating or whatever. And, you know, in a way, I'm happier with that kind of incompetence than sort of the implacable, gigantic bureaucracy that China is generating, you know, with some of the same kinds of goals, I suppose.
Because the market,
I mean, also,
because the market punishes incompetence.
Yes, I hope so eventually.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that is a question right now, right? Like, what would Facebook have to do to go out of business? You know what I mean? Like, what degree of incompetence could they manifest that would drive them out of business? But yes, I'd like to see market forces. You know, I think in principle, market forces are capable of correcting some of those problems, but they're definitely not capable of, nothing is capable of correcting the kinds of problems on the internet that the Chinese government is generating.
Right.
You know, there is no mechanism by which, you know, you can't boycott it. You know, you can't take your business elsewhere. I think we're better off in a free market atmosphere to the extent that we have that, but because we have these really monopolistic companies, it's coming down to just a few companies, and that's probably not the best situation.
As a philosophy professor, you're charged with answering the question, what is truth? And I
no problem.
Yeah, and I know you've written on this topic very interestingly. But I wanted to get your reaction to a statement that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made on Sunday night in her interview on 60 Minutes with Anderson Cooper, where she was sort of softly challenged by Anderson about the things that she has said that have been like wildly factually incorrect, like, you know, things like mm-hmm. the Pentagon budget being off by a factor of 25.
Right. What did she say? $21 trillion or something like
right.
that?
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and her response was essentially, it's more important to be morally right on the issue than it is to be technically correct.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like a lot of our discourse is along those lines. And, you know, you could say morally right, or you could say rhetorically convincing. Like, in other words, I think she's not just misstating facts. She's trying to convince people with misstatements of fact. But that's not, you know, that's not only happening on her side of the spectrum. Let's put it that way. You know?
Right. Sure.
But, you know,
but I mean, but the cultural implications of that in our political discourse.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I think it's impossible and disgusting, really. I mean, if you don't have a factual basis for policymaking, and if you actually regard that as irrelevant, I don't really want to listen to anything you say after that. I mean, I don't know what problems you think you're going to address, or, you know, I don't trust what you're telling me about maybe even the results of some kind of policy change or whatever. So I think that if someone really reveals that they are indifferent to the truth, I would simply stop listening to them. They continue to make factual claims, right? They continue to tell you what they believe or whatever in terms of like what the situation is on the ground that they're trying to address. So they seem to be making assertions, but I wouldn't even interpret that. They're telling you that they don't even care about whether what they're saying is true. At that point, they should just be kind of waved off, I think.
Right. You would hope there'd be a market correction there, too.
yeah.
I wanted to check back with you, like do a little bit of a stop, look and listen to where you think we're at in the denunciad. You wrote an op-ed a couple of years ago that I really enjoyed. And actually, another academic, you probably know, Anthony Esselin, writes about uh-huh. the same topic in his latest book, Out of the Ashes. And he talks about truly tolerant people are hard to offend because they're not looking to score points. They're not looking to bring others into ill repute. He writes, an owl is not offended by the little field mouse. It's just what the owl is on the lookout for. and the difference is, in the denunciad, as you wrote about, we are on the lookout to be offended, and thus we're offended, and it becomes this spiraling. And I wonder if you think that since you opined on that topic, things are improving or continuing to deteriorate.
Oh, I think it continues to deteriorate. Although I do think there's a little correction happening. Like, for example, I mean, a really good example of this whole thing was the Kevin Hart flap on the Oscars.
Yeah.
And to the point now where they're basically like, they're lost. No one can host the Oscars. I don't think anyone, I doubt that anyone can really reach the degree of purity necessary to host the Oscars. And probably no one has a good enough multiracial, multisexual identity, you know, to be the host of the Oscars and represent everyone correctly or something, or whatever is demanded. But yeah, I mean, so I think like, you know, It has become automatic. So you uncover these tweets by heart. You know, you expose them. You demand an apology. He kind of ritually apologizes, or, you know, who knows exactly what happened there. I haven't been paying that close attention. But then I think it's a little encouraging that in this case, it doesn't just seem to be, okay, that's the end of your career. Or come back in 2 years and try for a comeback or something like that. At least there's some defense. There's some sense of, okay, I think for one reason, it's that people like Kevin Hart.
Yeah, well, right. Yeah, yeah, your likability factor matters a lot to different standards attached. But on this point, though, speaking of Kevin Hart, he's in this new movie with Bryan Cranston. I think it's actually getting worse, and I think there is not so much of a correction going on. Yes, Kevin Hart survived.
Yeah.
He had some intemperate tweets or whatever, although he is a comedian. But Bryan Cranston is out defending himself as an actor playing a man in a wheelchair because he's not actually in a wheelchair.
Yes.
And it's like, do you understand the concept of an actor?
Absolutely.
So to me, that's the kind of stuff that's really concerning.
Yes, I agree with that completely. Yeah, and I mean, I kind of think of it as the representation wars. So the idea is that every movie has to kind of perfectly represent American demographics. Every actor has to be selected in terms of their own identity and so on. It's impossible. Or, you know, it's with authors as well. Like, could I write a fictional character who's in a wheelchair?
Right.
See, that, you know, if I was building my next novel around a character like that, okay, that's just an excellent, you know, if I could do that well, I would be a fine novelist. But I would definitely get condemned by, you know, for purporting to represent or embody a community that I don't. But of course, I never purported that at all. As you say, like, Bryan Cranston is an actor. That's exactly what we used to reward actors for being able to do, you know, like enter into the experience of someone who is disabled and present it so that we can understand it. I think it's getting absurd.
How much is how much has higher ed, the responsible party, and perhaps the source of some correction?
Well, I'm not sure. I'll say this: that idea that all representations are potentially threatening, and every representation has to be kind of, you know, whether it's a book or a professor's lecture or a movie or whatever, have to be perfectly calibrated demographically and so on. That rages on college campuses now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's more intense there than in the culture as a whole. I'm not sure if it emerged from there or if it just kind of, you know, came there and and settled in, but it's really extreme. And, you know, so any movie that you're showing at the student union or whatever is liable to be examined multiply in that way and protested perhaps, you know, and things like that. Yeah, and one thing I think is that people are just really quite confused about the relation of representation to reality. So I think you could get all the representations exactly politically correct. Like, say you had just all movies were perfectly demographically arranged and all the actors were the right sorts of people and so on. I don't think that would solve any of the problems of the society. And I think that's been demonstrated historically. So, for example, like in the Soviet Union, all you're getting is the portrayal of inspiring workers marching victoriously into a future bright with promise, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Every medium, all the time. That didn't make it true. That just made all those presentations grotesquely false. Right. You know, that didn't change the situation on the ground. Like, we're not going to solve American racism with the right movies. OK. You know?
Right.
Yeah. And I think people really misunderstand this. Like, it just seems obvious to me that that's not the most effective mode of activism or not where the problem lies, really.
He is Crispin Sartwell. He's associate professor of philosophy at Dickinson College, and his book, Entanglements, A System of Philosophy. Also check out his piece on Facebook and the Chinese government, The Wall Street Journal. Crispin, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Dan. Appreciate it.
Take care. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning. So you know how House Democrats largely were successful, including those here in the suburbs of Chicago, defeating Peter Roskam and Randy Helcrim. The issue of health care, the demagoguery of the left about the Republicans' position on health insurance for pre-existing conditions, people with pre-existing conditions. So what about, and look, Republicans deserve some blame for being back on their heels on that issue like they are on so many issues. But where are we with Obamacare at this point? Well, here's where we're at. You've got newly ascended House Democrats moving for the formal front door takeover of health care provision by the government. This piece in the Wall Street Journal this week, John Yarmuth, who's a Democrat member of the House from Kentucky, and the new House Budget Committee chairman, asked Congress's top economists to sketch out the options for a government takeover of America's health health insurance and, by extension, healthcare system. He wants to enact the Canadian-style system, single-payer, before patients and taxpayers understand exactly what it is they're losing, not dissimilar to what House Democrats, House and Senate Democrats did with President Obama. The memorialization of Yarmouth's memo to Congress's top economist, he acknowledges that the coverage and cost control promised by Obamacare didn't materialize. Yarmouth admits that many Americans are still uninsured and still struggle to afford their health care costs, which is a grand concession from a Democrat. He's not exploring market competition, of course, because he's looking for that takeover. This letter, Yarmouth asked for many details about how a government-run system might be structured and administered, but he makes it clear he's in no hurry to be informed on one particular aspect of the system, the cost, right? The cost that neither Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Comrade Bernie wanted to address either, although they haven't quarreled with the $33 trillion estimated price tag on what they have proposed. And a related story, while they're pushing for the Canadian-style system, Washington Examiner reporting last year, this is Sally Pipes who writes on healthcare for a long time, last year, Canadians waited a median of almost 20 weeks to receive specialist treatment after being referred by a general practitioner. 20 weeks. 5 months. Canada's single-payer system prohibits private insurance for medically necessary procedures. 20 weeks of waiting is bad enough, but in some areas in Canada, they fare even worse. The median wait for a treatment from a specialist following a referral from a GP in New Brunswick, for example, is nearly a year. It's the old P.J. O'Rourke joke about single-payer health care, government-run health care. The good news about that gallbladder surgery you need? It's free. The bad news is you're not going to get it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. About two decades ago, physics professor at NYU, Alan Sokol, did a bit of a sting with respect to all of these academic journals submitting basically fictional research work and seeing if it would get published to expose the lack of intellectual rigor with some of these journals and some of these intellectuals that are otherwise given great deference because of their credentials. We talked about this last quarter of last year. A group of academics did the same thing. What they did is submitted papers under the grievance studies rubric to have the same, to make the same exposures, or at least to test to see if there is rigor with respect to these journals in assessing the quality of the research that's submitted for publication. For example, and I mean also if anybody's even reading anything, or if they are, what is going through their minds? One article that was submitted to an academic journal by this group of academics, essentially operating as undercover intellectual agents, if you will. Human reactions to rape culture and queer performativity at urban dog parks in Portland, Oregon. a couple of academics who wrote on behalf of Peter Borgosian, who's a professor at Portland State University, said of dog park, "That was by far the silliest of our papers, which was a point we always intended to reveal in full to the public once our audit was completed. In it, we claimed extremely implausibly to have examined 10,000 dogs' genitals before interrogating their owners about their sexual orientations." The response is as absurd as the premise of the paper. some academics, they report, claiming that the problem with the paper isn't that we didn't is that we didn't actually examine the dog's genitals by the thousands. The only problem they have with the topic is the lack of legitimate data, that they didn't do the work, if you will. It's remarkable. So you would think exposing fraud, right? If you're propagating fraud through your own lack of due diligence, that's exposing fraud. These people who make decisions, publication decisions for these academic journals, particularly this whole research area of grievance studies, you think you'd be rewarded for that. People would be shamed. There'd be some accountability. There'd be new protocols put in place, especially since we've been here before, like with the Sokol incident, as I mentioned. And if you think that, you think whistleblowers or undercover academics interested in the integrity of academic journals, if you think they'd be rewarded, that's where you'd be wrong. The aforesaid Peter Boghossian is being disciplined by Portland State University, and at least as of the writing of this article I read on the topic, he potentially faces termination. He is a professor of critical thinking, science, and pseudoscience, and the philosophy of education and atheism at Portland State University. Peter Boghossian, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me on. Good morning, Chicago.
Good morning. So did I fairly characterize, summarize this whole timeline of what you and your colleagues did and where you currently stand?
Yeah, you did a pretty good job. So there are a lot of moving parts to this.
Yeah.
So we saw a problem in the academy, and we wanted to, we tried to talk to folks about it, but they were entrenched in this dogma, which really has a strong ideological grip on the academy, and it's starting to spill out into the academy. We saw a problem with scholarship that wasn't rigorous and that was corrupted. So we wrote 20 papers in a year, James Lindsay, Helen Pluck, Rose, and I, each one more preposterous, more asinine, and more ludicrous than the next.
Stiff competition.
And,
whoever came up with dog bark, clearly the winner.
Oh, thanks. Well, it was all of us as a team effort, but I go to the dog park every day. It is true that was a very, very silly and ludicrous paper, but really the other papers, fat bodybuilding, that there should be a space in traditional bodybuilding for morbidly obese people to come in. that was one that, I don't know, I don't know how much I can say on the air, but that men should self-penetrate and experience that with their girlfriends so they'll be less transphobic. That was one. But there were others that were all ludicrous about, you know, a gender scholar goes to Hooters and dialogue.
I like the fat bodybuilder thing because it reminds me of Chris Farley and Patrick Swayze on Saturday Night Live when they're both Chippendales dancers. We've actually come to that as legitimate academic exploration now that used to be just a bit on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, and it's a shame because people, that's eroding the confidence and the trust in our academic institutions, right? So we'd like to have a place or a can of literature, a body of knowledge where we can say, hey, you know, we know this. And how do we know this? We know this because it was studied and people tried to falsify it. And it's just, you know, it's a scientific method. But those mechanisms aren't in place in these journals. And as a consequence of this, people really have eroded trust in, have their trust eroded in public institutions.
And so you've been brought before some star chamber at Portland State University for crimes against academia. What, explain?
Professional misconduct, yeah. So I was found guilty of not seeking IRB approval. IRB is basically human subjects whenever you want to use human subjects. So even though there were no dogs, we didn't actually obviously look at any dogs' genitals and interrogate their owners as to their sexual orientation, but the IRB was claiming that the reviewers of the journal are the human subjects. But I want to say that I actually sympathize with the administration situation. You know, I don't know what kind of pressure they're under behind the scenes, but there was an anonymous public letter by, I think, 10 or 11 or 12 of my colleagues. They wouldn't even sign their name to it. It's basically a hit piece in the school newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I think if that's anything to go by, it's significant. So PSU really does need to make a decision, right? So they either need to use their institute of power to support me and the pursuit of truth, right? Because these folks have placed an agenda before the truth, an ideological and political agenda. Or they side with the grievance studies bullies and the people who are pressing them behind the scenes.
Well, and so you said you've been found guilty. So are you you're facing termination, as I understand it. Is that a possibility?
That can be. Look, fabrication of data is a very, very serious academic offense, as is plagiarism. You know, we plagiarized Mein Kampf, Hitler's book.
Right. And but I mean, right.
I'll cop to that one. I'm guilty to that. So, you know, we plagiarized Mein Kampf and rewrote it as a feminist text.
Right.
But these are very, very serious charges.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't be laughing, but it is really serious. I could face potential termination.
Well, it's serious because it's just through the looking glass. This is crazy. And I note some of your supporters too. I mean, this is not you mentioned ideology at the beginning, the ideology of the grievance studies folks. This is not like left right ideology. I noticed that people supporting you include, the noted atheist Richard Dawkins has written a letter on your behalf.
Yeah, well, I'm an atheist too, so I don't.
Well, there you go. Even more to my point.
Yeah, so here's what's really interesting: letters of support from everybody. It's so amazing. Students, academics, high-profile intellectuals—they're just flooding into PSU, and I really can't keep up. So these folks fully support our grievance studies probe because they're just fed up with this corruption of scholarship, and they're sick of university administrators supporting this cadre of bullies who operate in these disciplines. So they're saying enough is enough. And the interesting thing is that they're now putting their names on these letters, so they're not scared anymore. Mm. These people have bullied everyone in calling them racist, alt-right, Nazi, homophobe, sexist, misogynist, and people are tired of it. I'm tired of it.
Do you think that incidents like yours, but even the evolution of this, the sort of the mugging of Brett Weinstein at Evergreen State, Brett Weinstein, Jonathan Haidt, some of these other people that are getting together who are not, you know, conservatives like me, but they believe in academic freedom and the integrity of the education and the scholarship. Do you think that is actually turning the tide at all on college campuses?
That's a very, very difficult question. I don't know. You know, Brett's a very good friend of mine, and I just had drinks with him the other night. I don't know the answer to that question. We've talked about that extensively. I do want to say it is irrelevant to me that you are a conservative and I am a liberal.
Yeah.
You have conservative views, and any views that don't adhere to the dominant moral orthodoxy aren't welcome on campus anymore. And I want to hear your views, and I want to engage you publicly, and I want students to engage those views as well. And what we're seeing happen right now is that there is a dominant moral orthodoxy on university campuses, and if anybody doesn't toe the party line, they can't ask questions. And so conservatives are then losing trust in the university system, right?
Yes.
Liberals in conservatives who are there feel isolated and marginalized. And that's exactly the opposite of the way they should feel, because we should have a diversity of thought. So that's not what these folks are talking about when they throw out the word diversity and safe spaces and trigger warnings. So other problem with that is that liberals, people who hold liberal views, and I want to say one thing, people who hold liberal views, they don't get their views challenged. They only hear one side of the issue. So they become brittle in their ways of dealing with things. So they, you know, cry, or they're offended, or they call you names, or they run away. But they don't engage the arguments, right?
Yeah, and it would seem to me that an additional problem, too, that's maybe underappreciated, get your reaction, is you're going to lose great intellectuals, because they're not going to want to be in environments like this where you can be fired or have to go through this ordeal that you're going through because you're trying to properly expose less than quality scholarship.
That's correct. And I think it's really important to know that it doesn't happen to matter. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle the scholarship is coming from. Like, you know, phonology, bumps on the head thing, when people used to believe that you can make inferences about someone's intelligence and personality from bumps on the head, studying bumps on the head. So if somebody is if a bunch of liberals get together and they start propagating this ridiculous, belief system of phrenology, if I say, hey, wait a minute, there's not enough evidence for that, that doesn't make me a conservative. That just makes me a guy who thinks there's not enough evidence for phrenology, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what we have now is we have entire disciplines that have been corrupted academically. And as you mentioned, Brett said, he calls it idea laundering. This is just the perfect description. So a bunch of people get together. They have these strong moral impulses. Like, they really feel something. They don't know what to do about it. So they start journals and they launder their ideas. It starts as an idea. They put it through a peer review journal, and on the other side, it comes out knowledge. Then they take those papers that come out and they, not only do they teach kids in class, you know, our college kids, but when they're asked how they know something, unlike the Christian who says, well, I know it, I have my faith, these people point to their canon of scholarship. Well, this is how we know. But the problem is that those canons of scholarship are corrupted. Those papers are illegitimate. And what we did is we delegitimized those canons by showing that they're just preposterous.
Idea laundering. I do like that a lot. I think that's a great description of what's happening. He's Dr. Peter Boghossian. You're an evolutionary biologist, yes?
No, I teach philosophy at Portland State University at the moment. I teach philosophy at Portland State University.
Okay, at the moment. Professor of critical thinking philosophy at Portland State University. And also, too, were you an elected official in Oregon?
Yeah, I was a councilman for the state libraries, and I served on the prison advisory committee. I did my dissertation and then on how to improve the critical thinking and moral reasoning of prison inmates. And then I later ran for a little local office, or I don't even know if office is the right word, but a position here at Columbia River Correctional Institution.
No, interesting. Okay. All right. Well, good luck to you with respect to the disciplinary action you're facing at Portland State. We'll be following your story. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
He joins us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.